20-1492 Southern Iowa, White Communications et al. Versus Synergies 3 Tech Services et al.
May it please the court.
Let's see.
My name is Bill Graham, and I represent the plaintiffs.
Let me get you pinned, Mr. Graham, and then, very good.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Bill Graham. I represent the plaintiffs and appellants, White Communications, LLC, and Jeffrey White. Mr. White is a 30% owner of White Communications. The record reflects that the remaining shares of that company are owned by others, primarily by his mother.
Counsel, that brings up an important question for me, and that is, did Shirley and Jack White still own 70% of White Communications LLC at the time of the October 2016 operating agreement when that was signed?
The reason I'm hesitating, Your Honor, the answer is yes, certainly, as to both of them. What I was struggling with was when Jack died, and he did die during the pendency of these matters, but it was after that. So yes, Your Honor.
Well, my follow-up question is this: was White Communications LLC a party to the operating agreement in October 2016?
No, Your Honor.
If they're not, how could the operating agreement make the assignment and assumption agreement obsolete?
Well, I agree that it can't. It is our position that it could not do that.
And it seems to me that there's a divergence in interest here between the LLC and Mr. White that is a very glaring conflict of interest. Was that addressed in the district court?
Not as a conflict of interest, Your Honor, at least not to my recollection. But certainly the fact of the arguably competing interests, at least with respect to damages, was addressed for our part by the plaintiffs. We told the jury and acknowledged throughout that in the event of duplicative or duplicate damage awards between the two clients, we recognized we weren't entitled to double damages, and the jury was told that the court would take care of that problem if it were a problem.
Well, my concern, counsel, is that the brief seems to take contradicting positions that would prejudice White Communications LLC. On the one hand, Jeffrey White acknowledges that Synergies did not owe 4.5% to both the LLC and him personally. And yet it argues that the removal of him from membership cost him 4.5% under the operating agreement, and yet simultaneously argues in the reply brief on page 27 that the operating agreement did not supersede the assignment and assumption agreement.
That's all true, Your Honor, and I don't view that as anything more than a situation which we have often in tort cases involving multiple plaintiffs, where there is the potential for an award of duplicate damages. And we've, as I say, recognized from the outset that in the event of such awards, the court would be in a position to adjust that award.
But my concern is that opposing counsel takes advantage of that in their brief to argue that, well, the jury maybe didn't award very much to the LLC because they thought that the operating agreement made the assumption agreement void and ineffective and therefore gave them less money.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, that they did it. They did make that argument. I don't think that has... frankly, so much to do with a conflict in the two positions as it does with just a faulty argument on their part that a contract to which White Communications was not a party could somehow supersede one to which it was a party, a position which, as Your Honor knows, we reject.
But if it was not superseded, then how does Jeffrey White have 4.5% coming to him instead of the LLC?
He testified, Your Honor, my recollection is that he testified that the receipt by him of 4.5% of revenues going forward was a placeholder for White Communications and its entitlement. And he was upfront with the jury about that. So we were left in the position, Your Honor, and the record is in the position that there is a written contract, as Your Honor knows, specifically laying out Jeffrey White's entitlement. The recovery by White Communications is not based upon a written agreement. There was none. And in fact, as the jury found, it's based upon an implied contract. If I may, I will move then to a discussion first of Jeffrey White's position on this appeal, which is that the court should have granted his motion for judgment as a matter of law, both as made at the close of evidence and also after the jury verdict. The premise of that is that there was simply no evidence, frankly, not just an insufficiency of evidence, but no evidence that shows that the elements necessary to show a for-cause removal under the operating agreement had been met. This, of course, is not an employment case. It's a contract case, and it's one in which the contract specifically defines the term for-cause, and that, of course, was instructed by the jury as well. The burden of proof was on the defendants to show that the for-cause basis for removal of Mr. White from his company or from their company was supported by a showing that he had caused immediate or deferred economic or irreparable economic or reputational harm to the LLC or its business. There was simply no evidence of any of that. Even the hearsay evidence to which we object would not, even if it had been properly admissible, establish such evidence. There was.
Well, counsel, assume that the hearsay is admissible. We know here that the president of AT&T was made aware of this. And we know that they had a zero tolerance policy. Isn't it a reasonable inference the jury can make that that affected your client's reputation, or I'm sorry, the defendant's reputation at that point? Isn't that something that the jury can make that leap?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Not without more, and the more wasn't there. The fact is that I think that's particularly true, given that the misconduct by Jeffrey White was made in his role as a representative of White Communications and not in his role with Synergies. So it was derivative concern at best on the part of AT&T. And of course, AT&T didn't testify to any of that because they weren't brought in to testify. And so there was no evidence that AT&T even actually had that concern. And to say that there is a zero tolerance policy seems to me is not the same thing as saying your reputation has now been irreparably harmed, and those are quite different matters. I think somebody or something can be guilty of something for which there is zero tolerance without that necessarily resulting in irreparable reputational harm, particularly to a separate entity such as Synergies.
So, counsel, what would have been necessary there for AT&T to come in and say, "Hey, this damaged their reputation, and I'll never forgive them for it"? Is that basically what you have to have for irreparable reputational damage?
Clearly, that would have helped their case. I don't think it would have to be quite that direct, but as in all cases involving reputation, there would need to be evidence showing here was the reputation, here it is after the fact, this change, which presumably would be a negative change, cannot be fixed. Your reputation cannot be repaired. And yes, they would need either testimony directly from AT&T or facts which strongly gave rise to that inference. None of that was there. And in fact, as we point out in the brief, the defendants themselves acknowledged that they knew of nobody who thought less of Synergies because of what Mr. White had done. Now, that's in my view, an outright admission that there was not irreparable reputation damage.
Counsel, this is Judge Loken. I thought the evidence was pointed more toward the economic harm, or at least as much toward economic harm with the downturn in business and so forth. Then that doesn't have to be irreparable and unforgivable. That just has to be economic harm.
I don't think so, Your Honor, respectfully. Any economic harm,
apparently,
certainly.
Apparently the jury did. I mean, this is not a question of law, what those words mean.
Your Honor, the economic harm, which is certainly a separate prong of the for-cause removal definition, still had to be irreparable. Both types of harm had to be irreparable. With respect to economic harm, there was similarly no evidence. The defendants.
Well, let me just stop you there. What's a company that did poorly in 2020? ExxonMobil. Is that harm not irreparable because if the oil market turns around, they'll recover? What does irreparable economic harm mean when you have a severe downturn or a substantial downturn in business, but you're not dead?
Well, I think in the record in this case, a number of witnesses, including the defendants, were asked what they understood irreparable to mean, and they answered that it means they can't fix it.
Can you fix it when you have an operating loss for a substantial period of time? How do you fix that?
There was no evidence of an operating loss for a substantial period of time, Your Honor. The only evidence...
Lost business, lost revenues. Just lost revenues.
I don't concede that is not reparable depending on the amounts. Probably more importantly, Your Honor, there was no evidence of causation. The defendants point to that loss of territories, but they also acknowledge that they did not know whether that was caused by something Mr. White did. It happened 9 months later. And there was no evidence presented that it was caused by this text message or something that Mr. White did. And so I think regardless of whether it could be considered irreparable, the causation element is not there, Your Honor. Given the fact, as we view it, that no evidence, I see if I'm reading the clock right that I've already well impinged into my rebuttal time, and I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal unless there are other questions.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Hermans.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Haley Hermanson. I represent the appellees, Synergies 3 Tech Services, LLC, Eric Atchley, and Benton Odom, Jr.
Do you agree that the economic harm had to be irreparable to under the terms of the agreement? Or is irreparable only apply to reputational?
I believe that at trial it was inferred that irreparable applied to both the economic and the reputational harm.
Well, going back a little to Judge Loken's question, I mean, what does irreparable harm mean in this context? Is there a difference between irreparable harm and the notion of irreparable damages? Because in Iowa law, irreparable damages, I mean, economic loss is rarely an irreparable damage. So is there a distinction here when we're talking about irreparable harm? And what is the meaning of that term as it's in the agreement?
I believe that it would be a subjective standard, being that it was a vote of four or five members. You would ask, what did the four voting members think as a vote?
Is that in the contract? In other words, is it that the four voting members have a reasonable belief that their business has suffered irreparable harm? I don't recall that's what it said. And I guess what I'm looking for is, where do I go to define that term? Your opposing counsel suggests we go to background Iowa common law. And I'm wondering, if we don't do that, where do we go?
Are you specifically referring to irreparable or reputational?
Let's talk about irreparable economic harm at this point, but I think the question applies to both.
Sure. Well, I think that a vote of four or five members necessarily implies a subjective standard. You'd have to ask what the four voting members thought as of the date of removal, and all four testified that they felt that following their investigation, they had no choice but to remove Mr. White if they were to save their business.
Would the court then apply a reasonableness test to that? Otherwise, essentially four members could expel the fifth without cause as long as they subjectively think he should be out, right? Or am I misstating that?
I guess a reasonable basis would be sufficient. Yeah, I think a common sense meaning of the word would be appropriate.
And I guess my problem is that's not in the contract.
Sure, but neither is the actual harm standard that Mr. Graham has advocated for. And it's really just, did the business suffer immediate or deferred, irreparable, reputational or economic harm to Synergies or its business? And I think that you would need to include deferred in there to allow the members to act in a way that could prevent or mitigate the harm if possible.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Was the LLC a party to the agreement under which the terms of foreclause removal were agreed to?
The operating agreement was signed by the five individual members of Synergies. So it was the governing document of the LLC.
So would you agree that an LLC is a legally distinct entity from Mr. White?
Yes.
And so could Synergies have removed Jeffrey White for cause without disturbing the role of the LLC?
So I think that you were right when you were pointing out the conflicting interests of the plaintiffs. I think that ultimately what the jury could reasonably infer was that Jeffrey White took the 4.5% for himself. And it really was a conflict of interest because the White Communications claim was probably against Jeffrey White rather than Synergies for taking that 4.5% for himself.
Yeah, and counsel, I'm not blaming you for any of the arguments you've made. I'm just wondering if the LLC wasn't hopelessly prejudiced here by the failure to recognize the conflict of interest.
Do you mean White Communications, Your Honor?
Yes.
I think that perhaps the conflicting interest between Jeffrey White and White Communications may have acted to the LLC's detriment, but that was the way that they chose to proceed at trial. I'd like to, if I can, turn to the sufficiency of the evidence, because I think that it's very important to note that all of plaintiff's arguments on appeal related to Jeffrey White's claim presuppose that he met his burden of proof. He just skips over whether or not he met every element required for his breach of contract claim and goes straight to the issue of whether Synergies met its burden on the affirmative defense. However, if you look at verdict number 4, which is on page 179, you'll see that the jury simply found in favor of Synergies 3. We don't know whether they ever even reached the issue of for-cause removal. In fact, they could have just as easily concluded that Jeffrey White failed to meet...
Say that again. Wait, I didn't understand. Was verdict number 4 said what?
Verdict number 4 was Jeffrey White's claim for breach of the operating agreement, and the jury just simply found in favor of Synergies. So we don't know.
So if the contract was ambiguous with respect to irreparable, the district court sent it to the fact finder who implicitly made its determination.
Sure. Or
I assume Iowa law is like most every other state on that in that regard. The contract is unambiguous. It's an issue for the court. If it's ambiguous, you need a fact finder to sort out the ambiguity. Was it charged that way or not? Or was it ignored in the instructions?
The instructions, instruction number 6 required Jeffrey White to prove the existence of the contract, consideration, the terms of the contract, that he did what the contract required of him, that Synergies 3 failed to pay him the amounts owed or removed him, and damages. Mr. White presents no real argument on appeal or does not articulate precisely how he supposedly met his burden as to each of these elements. And we dispute that he did, and we believe that the jury could have easily concluded that Jeffrey White did not meet his burden and found four synergies on that basis, in which case they wouldn't even have reached the issue of the affirmative defense of the for-cause removal. Specifically, the jury could have found that Jeffrey White failed to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he did what the contract required and that he had been damaged in any amount. On page 164 of Appellant's Appendix, you'll see that the operating agreement required its members to devote its best time and efforts to furthering the business and financial goals of the LLC. The jury could have found that Mr. White failed to meet his burden of proof on that element. Additionally, the operating agreement provided that Jeffrey White was entitled to a one-time payment of $250,000 following his removal, yet it was undisputed at trial that he received sums totaling $1.75 million after his removal. So the jury could have found that he was not damaged in any amount. And if Jeffrey White failed to meet his burden of proof on any one of these elements, then the jury would not have needed to reach the issue of the affirmative defense. I'll turn now to some of the evidentiary rulings that Mr. Graham referenced. Specifically, he mentioned hearsay with respect to Exhibits G and H. I would note that plaintiffs did not raise the issue of the business record exceptions in their post-trial briefings. They only argued that the certain stated non-hearsay purposes were, in fact, actually offered for their truth. They did not identify which specific statements they took issue with, and so the court analyzed the issue with respect to Exhibits G and H, but we don't believe that the business records argument was preserved for appeal, or at the very minimum, it was waived. There was no confusion over the court's rulings. They were two very distinct rulings. Exhibits G and H were admitted in their entirety under the business records exception, and Roger Hope's testimony with respect to Exhibits G and H was admitted for the stated non-hearsay purpose of the impact that it had on voting members. With respect to the economic and reputational harm, I would also like to note that it is disjunctive in the operating agreement, meaning a finding in favor of Synergy 3 on either would have sufficed had the jury reached the issue of for-cause removal. As you pointed out, the simple fact of receiving that email from the Office of the President with that vulgar text message attached, I think we can all agree would be damaging to the reputation of a business. And likewise, the loss of territories, specifically territories in which White Communications had operated prior to the merger, is economic harm, and it's a reasonable inference that the jury could draw that shortly after the text, the specific territories tied to Jeff White were lost.
Counsel, what about the argument that, again, reputational harm here I don't think is defined in the agreement. And opposing counsel suggests then we should look to Iowa law again, and in this case, Iowa defamation law, which requires some evidence of, in this case, it would be pre-breach reputation in order to establish that there's actual reputational harm. Well, why don't we do that when we have an undefined term?
Sure. And again, I think you would look at the common sense meaning of the word. If you go to even Iowa standard jury instructions on defamation, reputational harm is not defined. And as far as evidence of reputation prior to and after the text message at issue, in defamation cases, evidence of reputation prior to the alleged defamation is relevant in showing the measure of damages or the negation of damages. We didn't seek damages from Jeff White. This was an affirmative defense to his breach of contract claim, and the common law decisions geared at protecting a person's interest in his or her own name is not the proper measure for an affirmative defense on a breach of contract claim. Synergies was, not required to prove publication of a statement of a concern in Synergies. So I don't think that reputational harm should be defined by common law defamation standards. And regarding Roger Hope's testimony on the zero tolerance policy that you had mentioned, his testimony was during his time when he was employed by AT&T, he worked in a department handling customer relations, and he had seen companies terminated for contravening the zero tolerance policy, which prohibited any sort of unprofessional conduct by its employees or independent contractors. Your Honors, I think in sum, I'd like to say that the system here worked as law contemplates. The issues in this case were decided on their merits by a jury following 4 days of trial. Plaintiffs spent much of their case in chief trying to disprove that any harm had come to Synergies rather than proving up their breach of contract claim. Even if they had reached the issue of for-cause removal, however, Synergies presented sufficient evidence showing that its four voting members reasonably believed that it had suffered or would suffer irreparable economic or reputational harm as a result of Mr. White's text, and that his actions warranted for-cause removal. And because sufficient evidence properly admitted at trial supported the jury's findings, the district court's refusal to overturn the verdict was proper, and we ask this court to affirm.
Counsel, on the implied contract damages argument, your brief didn't respond to the argument that district court erred by quoting the Scott case on the standard when the jury verdict charged a different standard. Was it erred to rely on Scott or not?
I don't believe so. The proper measure of damages for a breach of implied contract claim is the reasonable value of the goods and services, and there was simply no evidence presented at trial as to what the value of the services and the techs and equipment that White Communications gave to Synergies was. In fact, when Mr. White was asked about it, he just referenced the initial $400,000 payment. And I see my time has expired, unless there are any further questions.
Very good, thank you. Mr. Graham for rebuttal. You're muted, counsel. There we go.
Oftentimes judges like it if I'm muted, but thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for alerting me to that. On this latter point of the question of how the law should be measured on the implied contract, our view is simply this, that's determined by the instructions and the verdict form, and that there was no challenge to that.
Well, no, but no, I think there's another aspect to this, because opposing counsel notes that in response to a jury question, which obviously came after the instructions, your client, trial counsel, agreed it must award the amount requested if reasonable or must be based on the evidence presented. That trumps anything to the contrary in the verdict form, doesn't it?
Well, it wasn't intended to, and speaking as that counsel, Your Honor, I can tell you that what we were recognizing is the fact that any decision by the jury has to be based upon the evidence. That does not mean we're saying you can now ignore the instructions, and we did not say that, Your Honor.
Well, I know, but it's a highly, this notion that it can't be Scott because Scott didn't use the same language as the jury instruction is highly technical. And it seems to me if there was then a further question from the jury on this issue and clarification by the trial court, that's all we have to look at. That's the point.
I take your point, Your Honor. I respectfully don't agree that was the intent of either the court's response to the question or of counsel's, for that matter. If I may also address briefly in my next 43 seconds, there's been a suggestion, a strong suggestion now by counsel that somehow our position on appeal is undermined because the jury could have found that Mr. White didn't prove his side of the contract breach claim. First of all, that doesn't change the defective nature of the evidence on the affirmative defense that they had to prove. But more importantly, perhaps, there was no dispute at all in this case on any of the other issues. The record is before the court and has been briefed by the parties. The other elements of the contract were overwhelmingly established, and nobody ever claimed that they weren't. And so it really did, the entire case on this point for Mr. White was decided and determined and tried on the question of the for-cause removal language, which we do not believe would be subjectively determined by the owners, but rather determined by the evidence of whether the damage had occurred, which we think was deficient. Thank you. Unless there are further questions, my time has expired.
Thank you.